From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Donald Trump may be the least politically experienced person in modern history to have assumed the office of president. From the moment he started his job, constitutional experts warned that he was in violation of various parts of our Constitution, particularly the Emoluments Clause. Since January 2017, he is engaged in what appears to be so many violations of the Constitution that most of us have lost count, become numb to, or simply can't keep up with the barrage. Deep familiarity with the Constitution ought to be a prerequisite for becoming president, but it's not, and the perils of that are now clearer to us than perhaps any time before. To help future presidents, my guest has written a book, a helpful guide to the Constitution, if you will. Corey Brettschneider is professor of political science at Brown University. He's the author of When the State Speaks, What Should It Say? How Democracies Can Protect Expression and Promote Equality, and Trump versus the Constitution. He joins me to discuss his newest book, The Oath and the Office, a guide to the Constitution for future presidents. Welcome to the program, Corey.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and to continue to talk about these themes.
Right. We've had you on our program several times before, and this definitely seems to be a book for our times. How does Trump compare to his predecessors in familiarity with the Constitution and knowledge of the Constitution? We know that President Obama was well-versed in the Constitution, so that might be an unfair comparison, perhaps. But what about others before him?
Yes, he was a constitutional law professor, so I think that's an unfair comparison. I think that what's historic about Trump is the disposition to not only violate, but really say things and do things that are head on with both the ideals and principles of the Constitution and its specific requirements. So part of it is, I think there is a lack of knowledge, certainly of the of basic civics, really, that goes beyond even knowing about the Constitution. And worse than that, it's a sort of disposition to be hostile to the rule of law. But I don't want to pretend that everything he's doing is unprecedented. So I talk about why, although in my view, the Supreme Court decided the travel ban case in the wrong way, there is, and it is unconstitutional, that there is precedent for this travel ban based on ethnic prejudice in the Chinese Exclusion Act, for instance. I talk about how his racist statements, although they're at odds with the obligation of a president to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution, why Woodrow Wilson, for instance, historically did also in his statements that were used in Birth of a Nation, a film celebrating the Ku Klux Klan, and his showing of that in the Oval Office, why that in a way is a sort of prior example of another president who also was disregarding the Constitution. So yes, I mean, Trump sort of is a perfect storm. He's violated almost every provision that I can think of. And the book, you know, calls him out or makes it clear when he should be called out for that. But I also don't want to hide from the tendency of past presidents to also violate the Constitution. But I'd say he's certainly probably the worst when it comes to constitutional violation.
So it's not just Trump, but previous presidents and future presidents, of course, where we need to have this familiarity with the Constitution. It seems to me also to be something that ordinary people should have some familiarity with the Constitution, with the Bill of Rights. Children need to know their right to sit down during the Pledge of Allegiance at school, for example. And, you know, it's an issue that's come up in my family, and I've seen it come up in schools. So familiarity with the Constitution is quite important. And the Republican Party, for so many years, presented itself as the defenders of the Constitution, and that was their main basis for so many of the things that they did. It seems as now they are sort of on the wrong side of that in the most obvious way. So what would you, what are some of the ways in which you characterize the authority of the president? Because that's a really important issue, executive authority. Trump came in signing one executive order after another. He's still doing so nonstop. What is the, how do we define the limits of executive authority?
I go back to, you know, maybe the most obvious place, but the most important to look, and that's the second inaugural address of George Washington. And what he says there is He reminds us, first of all, that the president, the first second in office, says, takes an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. And then in the shortest inaugural address of all time, 135 words, what Washington says in an incredibly pithy, to-the-point address is, look, I've just taken this oath to uphold the Constitution. And what he implies is it's not just not violating it, it's going beyond that, protecting it, promoting it, defending not the country, but the Constitution. And if I fail to do that, Washington says to the people assembled in Philadelphia, mostly members of Congress, subject me to criticism and subject me to constitutional punishment. And what I say in the book is, although this is the second inaugural, it's very early in the Republic's history, it really resonates with right now. And Washington is really in that address speaking to all of us and saying, look, this is, you know, partly about the obligation of a president, but a president who fails to do that can only really be checked by the people. And the people have to know this document thoroughly, and they have to be prepared to step in and stop such a president. Part of what I'm arguing for is that the next presidential election really has to be a referenda on the Constitution. And certainly if Donald Trump is running again, a vote against him is essential for Republicans and Democrats who want to defend it. But also there are ways to stop a president and that people need to know about in the meantime, including perhaps impeachment. And I talk extensively about that, but other ways as well. For instance, the role of the states like California, I profile Miguel Marquez in Northern California leading the fight to use the state and locality's constitutional authority to resist ICE when it demands that they be held, that people arrested for parking tickets, for instance, or speeding tickets be held for 48 hours until they can come. So you really hit the nail on the head. It is a book, the device is about future presidents, and maybe a future president will read this, but it's also primarily for citizens who want to hold the president in check.
What about the idea that the Constitution is a document? It's a living document, after all. And at the time when it was framed, of course, the framers weren't entirely noble. We had many stains on our nation at the founding of the nation. And that, of course, we've amended the Constitution over time. And that even today, this is a document that is malleable. I mean, is that a strength that it's a malleable document or a weakness? Because, you know, it can't be too malleable.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there sometimes is a contrast that's drawn between the original understanding of the Constitution, the sort of Scalia view that I argue against in the book, and the living view. And I guess I put it slightly differently in the book. I say, you know, what the framers were really bad at were many of their practices. In fact, many of them were evil, especially the original sin and the original evil of slavery, which, you know, they weren't hypocrites. They knew it was evil, but yet they did it anyway. They just had a weakness, I think, when it came to basically their own financial security. But when it came to the values that they put in there, and the idea, for instance, of a limited presidency, the idea that Article II grants certain powers to the president that the president can't go beyond, the idea of a Bill of Rights that constrains what a president can and can't do, that those ideas really from the beginning were there. And what it's the living part, I think, is that it's up to us to demand that we live up to those ideals. They were in the Declaration, and they're also in the original Constitution, and they're certainly in the Bill of Rights. So the living part is we are the living people. It's not that there's no Constitution police. The document's not self-reinforcing. We have to demand that these values are placed into action today. And the document is particularly good. The thing that the framers were terrific at is realizing that a president like Trump could come along, that there were demagogues who would play to the crowd, would use prejudice basically over reason to get elected. And then they put all these fail-safes in there to help us. Now, it's not a perfect document. I'm not saying it's going to save us, but it does give us many tools to use in stopping such a president.
Corey, you and I are talking around the time when the Senate Judiciary Committee is going through confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. You have a chapter in your book called The Power to Nominate Supreme Court Justices. And you've written your book as a guidebook, talking to a person who has either become president or about to become president or considering become president. So I want to quote from that chapter in your book. You're back at the White House, you write, mulling over the list of possible nominees for the vacant Supreme Court seat. What qualities should you look for in a justice? Well, answer that question for us. If you were talking to a potential someone interested in running for president, what qualities should one look to in a Supreme Court justice?
I mean, one of the essential ones is independence. And ironically, this is going to take a lot for a president. It takes somebody with Washington's disposition who can distinguish between the person and the office. But you have to look for somebody who's not going to just protect the person that nominated him or her. So I think understanding the limits of executive power is particularly essential, not just sucking up basically to the president that nominates a future justice. And that's why I've spoken out so forcefully against this nominee. Of course, we're hearing about the awful charges of sexual assault and attempted rape by this nominee. But I, even before that information came out, was also concerned about his view of executive power. One of the most important cases that I discuss in the book is U.S. versus Nixon, this great moment where the Supreme Court, in a unanimous decision, 8-0, with Justice Rehnquist recusing himself because he had been in the Nixon administration, they said to Richard Nixon, you have to turn over to a special prosecutor in a criminal investigation the Watergate tapes, because there's information there that is about potential criminality among both the president's associates and even potentially the president himself. Now, Judge Kavanaugh, and I don't talk about Kavanaugh specifically in the book, but I do talk about the importance of this case, has not shown that kind of independence. He's flip-flopped. When he was prosecuting a president, Bill Clinton, he talked about U.S. v. Nixon as a great case and its broad authority to stop a president. And then when he started working for a president, he started to say, you know, maybe this case is either wrong. He, at one point, he did say that. And then even when he defends it in recent times, he narrows it so much so that it wouldn't apply in the current Mueller situation. So that's not what you want. You want somebody who's independent, who gets the idea that the Supreme Court is a check on the presidency. Now, that takes a lot for a future president to nominate such a person. But in U.S. v. Nixon, let's remember, there were eight justices that were nominated and confirmed who said exactly that.
On this issue of independence, how do you view the fact that Kavanaugh went on Fox News, the primary media outlet that President Trump takes seriously, to make his case to the public ahead of a Supreme Court, this latest Supreme Court hearing? That seems to be a pretty clear indication of his lack of independence and where he wants to go. I mean, I can only imagine the flip side. Had we been talking about a Democratic president and who was nominating a liberal judge, and had that liberal judge gone on MSNBC right before their confirmation hearing, how we'd be, you know, hearing screams of a bias, political bias.
Yeah, I mean, I emphatically agree. I think that if you wanted a sort of, you know, my chapter is about what kind of nominee you should look for. It also is about the kind of nominee that you shouldn't look for. And I talk about Judge Bork and his failed nomination. And I criticize the account of originalism that Bork and Scalia later gave as examples of a philosophy not to look for. But this nominee in many ways is even worse than Scalia and Bork, I think way worse, because he even lacks the pretense of an independence. I mean, this going on Fox News is something that a partisan operative does, not a future Supreme Court justice.
Corey, you have a chapter in your book about the power as commander-in-chief. This is an absolutely critical power because the president essentially is the what buck stops with the president when we're talking about uses of the U.S. military, all branches of the U.S. military. Donald Trump wants to have Space Force. He wants to militarize space. He is essentially turned over to the general's oversight of our various wars. The more hawkish, the better, the more reason to spend our precious tax dollars on weapons of war, the better. He and his two predecessors before him have been acting under authorization for war that seems to have grabbed power from Congress. What guide would you give, or guidance would you give, current or future presidents about the limits of their authority as commander-in-chief?
This is an area, going back to your original important question, where it isn't just Trump. It really is the modern presidency, I think, has gotten so far from what the framers believed about war and what the document requires and what the basic values of the document requires. And all three of those things matter. The idea from the framing on and in the text is that we took what had been a unified power and the ability of a king to initiate war and also carry it out and split it up. We divided these so-called prerogative powers so that, yes, the president is commander-in-chief, but it is clearly Congress that can declare, and another word for that is initiate war, start a war. And the framers were very rightly skeptical about war because it, you know, is inherently violent and involves death and is worrying. It distracts from the ability to carry out any domestic agenda. And so they wanted to divide that power so that it was hard to start a war. And you require Congress for that, not a president. Now, recent presidents have disregarded that. I profile some lawsuits that would attempt to stop presidents from initiating war and demand it for Congress, because the courts have abdicated their responsibility here. These lawsuits were unsuccessful because the courts have said that this is a so-called political question that they won't get involved in. So what I suggest is that we need a new act passed by Congress to reclaim their war power and to make it clear in the act that this is a constitutionally mandated power of Congress and that courts actually can stop a president with an injunction who seeks to start a war. I say, you know, this is one way forward to start to correct the really bad imbalance that Democrats and Republicans are culpable of. And, you know, you could see in these suits that are brought by Democrat members of Congress, including, I think, from Berkeley, Congressman Dellums at one point, and then suing Republican presidents. And then you have suits as well by Republican members of Congress trying to stop Democrat presidents. What that tells me is that there's something wrong here. This has become a partisan affair. And really, the common denominator is that Congress has abdicated its responsibility and allowed presidents to take over. The real requirement that we limit war by demanding it be declared by Congress.
Now, I mentioned the Emoluments Clause at the beginning of our conversation, and this often hasn't been much of an issue. You know, Jimmy Carter and his peanut farm keep coming up when we talk about conflicts, potential business conflicts of interest that presidents might have. And so it hasn't been as much of an issue, except for Carter, until Trump came along. And we seem to be in somewhat uncharted territory. Shouldn't future presidents completely absolve themselves of business interests before assuming the oath of office of president? It seems to me such an obvious direct violation and conflict of interest, rather, that a president have such big business interests. I mean, I just want to bring up one story that went almost unreported. You and I are talking the same week that the United Nations General Assembly met. And the new president of Zimbabwe, Emmerson Mnangagwa, admitted to the press that before the United Nations meeting, he was meeting with New York investors and Trump business staffers about offering wildlife land in Zimbabwe for free for Trump to open a golf course on. Zimbabwe is under sanctions from the United States dating back to Mugabe's rule. It went almost unnoticed. It was such a blatant violation of the Constitution and a conflict of interest, and we have now normalized it under Trump.
Yeah, and you know, there are just so many of these stories. I guess it's overwhelming. The press is really not doing their duty, unlike you, in reporting it. I mean, there was another story, too, about him seeking intellectual property rights in China, and at the time that there was a battle over recognizing Taiwan, and then miraculously he got the rights and he backed off the claim that Taiwan had to be recognized. So, you know, let me just say what the Emoluments Clause requires. It requires that a president, it needs a new name maybe, but that the president not profit from the office. Going back to Washington, right, the idea of the office is that it's public, the public good that a president is serving and not the private purposes or private profit. And so they put that clause in there to make it very clear that you can't use the office, you can't use government in order to, you know, basically enrich yourself. And, you know, there are two ways to enforce it. One is an ongoing lawsuit that I'm fully supportive of, that attorneys general in Maryland, I believe, there's one other state, are engaged in. So I hope that suit goes forward, and they should have an injunction that requires the president to put his or her holdings into a blind trust, as recent presidents have done. And then there is, of course, another remedy, which is that certainly this is, if he refuses to do this, this is a ground for impeachment, I think, among others.
Corey, we've talked about the limits to presidential power just because the president, there's been so much overreach in the past year and a half. Let's talk about what a president ought to do with their power, what that office was designed for. You have a chapter in your book called The Bully Pulpit. What is the bully pulpit when it comes to the president, and how can and should a president use such a bully pulpit? Trump might argue he's using his bully pulpit quite effectively.
Yeah, it's one of the most important. Yeah, one of the most important things about the presidency, I think, that people often miss is that the president can speak to the public as a whole. The origin of the bully pulpit really comes from, well, it comes from Teddy Roosevelt, and bully meant, you know, basically cool, or, you know, like a good thing, not hitting people over the head. And it was Wilson who made it a constitutional, I think, part of the office, and he was deliberately trying to expand presidential power. Now, I think that the bully pulpit, like any power, can be used for ill or good. And Wilson, unfortunately, as I said, used it really in opposition to the idea of the core constitutional principle in the 14th Amendment of equal protection under law. So the expansion also came with the use of it, not to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution, as the bully pulpit needs to be used according to the oath, but to oppose those basic ideals. Now, Trump has expanded the bully pulpit even more. Because with Twitter, he doesn't need to go, as Wilson did, or as Teddy Roosevelt did, or most presidents have had to, through a press office. He doesn't need the press as an in-between him and the people. He can speak directly to them. And of course, there are rumors that he's exploring other ways of doing this, for instance, through cell phones directly, using one rumor is through the FEMA system. Who knows if he'll succeed in doing that? But he's already, through Twitter, expanded it. And my point in the book is, you have to judge a president here, too. This isn't going to be courts, but it certainly is citizens who are going to vote in whether or not he or she is using this massive power to support the ideals of the Constitution, to go beyond them or against them. And here I really do think that Trump is different from other Republican presidents. So think of what George Bush said after 9/11 when he said Islam is a religion of peace. He could have gone the way of Trump and stoked fears and used it to political advantage, but he didn't. He stopped. Those of people who were using 9/11 to stoke racial prejudice. President Obama also, at the same time, recognizing and promoting the idea of the right to free speech in the face of the burning of a Quran in California, in the face of a film disparaging the Prophet Muhammad, instead of using those incidents to try to shut down speech, he was very creative. He used the bully pulpit to explain not just to Americans, but to people around the world, that in this country, yes, we protect all viewpoints, all opinion, but also as president, he was on behalf of the nation condemning these bigoted acts. And so I think the bully pulpit can be used for ill, as I said, but it can also be used for good, as those two recent presidents showed it could be.
Corey, as we alluded to earlier, the book is a guidebook for presidents, future presidents, but also, of course, ought to be read by all of the rest of us, whether we intend to run for president someday or not. And you have a very compelling sounding chapter in your book, simply entitled, How to Stop a President. So what are our rights as citizens who are supposed to be living in a democracy to stop a dangerous president? What right does the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, give us?
I give three examples there, and that chapter is a nice introduction to the three ways of stopping a president. Because let's be honest, you know, George Washington had this respect for the Constitution and said, if I violate it, then subject me to constitutional punishment. But we have a president right now that disregards the oath and is hostile to it. So how can we stop a president like that who disregards the oath? There are three ways. The first, I say, although scholars disagree and the framers disagreed about whether or not you can indict a sitting president, Alexander Hamilton seemed to think you had to impeach and then remove and then indict. James Wilson from Pennsylvania and the ratifying Pennsylvania Convention said that the president's not above the law. Basically, yes, you can indict. On my view, the case law, which helps us here, and the values that Wilson was talking about, actually support the idea that one can and should actually indict a sitting president who has violated the criminal law. So I take a strong stance that if Mueller, in his investigation, finds out that the president is violating did violate the criminal law, either in the Russia investigation or in the business investigations that are in the Southern District of New York, that those prosecutors also can and should indict President Trump while he's in office. And that, my point is, that's a separate idea from impeachment. It's laid out in the principles of the Nixon case that a president is not above the law, and the idea in the Clinton versus Jones case that a president isn't too busy to be indicted, that you can work out the schedule in a way that allows for the criminal process to proceed. So that's the first big one. The second is the role of the states, as I mentioned. The 10th Amendment says that those powers not given to the federal government are reserved to the states. And I tell the story early in the Republic's history of how when the Alien and Sedition Acts were passed, a law that made it a crime to criticize the president of the United States, but not a crime to criticize the vice president, a member of a different party, Thomas Jefferson. It was a crime to criticize President Adams, but not Vice President Jefferson, that Jefferson himself and James Madison, these two framers, went back to Virginia to say, you know what, we're going to have the states agree that they are not going to comply with unconstitutional action by the federal government. And they provided a legal way for states to resist. And that's what's happening in the sanctuary cities movement, I think, right now. So when Miguel Marquez in Santa Clara and teams up with San Francisco and they say, we're not going to comply with ICE, our local police force, when they say we have to hold people who are arrested for minor violations if they're suspected of being undocumented, I say that's the tradition of Jefferson and Madison. And then the final chapter, the hero of which is Frederick Douglass, the 19th century orator and former slave, when he says that, you know, what treason isn't just a crime, it's a violation of the oath, the demeaning of the office, and the failure of then President Johnson to first President Johnson to really enforce the 13th Amendment and make good on the promise to end slavery, that that's an impeachable offense. I say that's exactly right, that this is different from the criminal process. And a president who really systematically, not just one time, but systematically disregards the oath of office should be impeached and removed through our political process of impeachment.
Corey, Brett Schneider, so much more to discuss with you. I certainly encourage my listeners and viewers to pick up a copy of your new book and read it, because the better versed the all of us are in the Constitution, I think the better it is for our country. Good luck to you with the book, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, and thanks for such great questions. And yes, this is a referendum coming up in the midterms and in the presidential election on the Constitution. Read the book and be sure to vote the right way.
Corey Brett Schneider is a professor of political science at Brown University. He's the author of When the State Speaks, What Should It Say? How Democracies Can Protect Expression and Promote Equality. Also, Trump versus the Constitution. His newest book that we've just been discussing is The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and now on Instagram at RU with Sonali.